Hello, this podcast is recorded on Gadigal country and we pay our respects to the First Nations custodians of the land, both here and also wherever you're listening from. Previously on Chat 10 Looks 3.
Are you still laughing about Deadpool?
Look, I just feel the need to address my continuing Ryan Reynolds deep dive. Now, if you listen to the last podcast episode, I must apologise because I spent a solid 15 minutes in a cry laughing monologue about the plots of Deadpool and Deadpool 2.
This is not going to be another Ryan Reynolds one, is it?
Luckily for you, I've not yet seen Deadpool 3. That's our latest this year. No, it is going to be another Ryan Reynolds one because you at least will be happy to know that my Ryan Reynolds deep dive has come to a screaming halt.
Can you scream in a deep dive? Anyway, I'm just...
It's probably silent. It's metaphor probably just alert. Like a big yawn.
The metaphor police are speeding their way to this location.
I blame Murph. Murph recommended that I watch a movie called Free Guy, which she said that I'd really like, that she really liked. I couldn't watch it for more than 20 minutes. It was set inside a video game. And so Ryan Reynolds an NPC, non-playable character, who goes kind of a bit rogue. And I was watching it thinking, Murph, when did you mistake me for a 13-year-old boy? I'm not into this at all.
When I listened to the last podcast, in all likelihood. I mean, how can you possibly – see, this is your genius. You can go so low rent and then make it look like that is kind of the natural and good way to be.
Yeah.
And then still manage to double down and humiliate your friend in the process of just going, I'm sorry. Don't know what you see. I'm more of a Deadpool kind of person.
Did you like Free Guy?
I thought it was fine.
Wow.
I watched it with my 13-year-old son.
Maybe I was just...
We both had a nice evening.
Maybe I was just in a bit of a mood or something.
You think?
But don't you worry, I've got some other low-rent pop culture content as well for you coming right up.
I know you have, love. You may as well come on, bring it.
Okay, so...
Yeah, I know.
I went to Taylor Swift.
I know. Yeah.
Now, it feels like a little bit like everyone's finished talking about Taylor Swift, so I won't.
No, because like as a person who, you know, our whole family queued for hours with absolutely no result online.
You're going to hate me.
Sure. No, bring it.
You're going to hate me even more because I wasn't even the person who queued online. Lisa Miller did that. She did the heavy lifting and then I was just, when she got the tickets, I was like, oh, okay, I'll be coming on one of your spare ones, thanks. So that was great. Look, it was obviously everything everyone said about it. It was an amazing show. The crowd watching was as fun as the actual show. I just wanted to, for people that are interested in Taylor Swift, there's just a few things I wanted to point you to. What's so funny about that?
Should I remain? That's okay. I'll do some voice exercises.
Okay, I wrote a piece for ABC
New York. Unique New York.
I read a piece for ABC News online about the concert and what I think, you know, my kind of just 2 cents worth, since every other journalist in the world had written an opinion piece about Taylor Swift. I barreled one up as well.
Oh, did you?
Yes,
I did. I genuinely missed that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's
none of my friends were talking about
just
it.
Just Google Lee Sales Taylor Swift and it'll come up.
Again,
along with the duet we did at the Melbourne concert. There's a great piece by our old mate, Taffy Brodesser Ackner.
Oh, fantastic. Hi, Taffy.
It's called, and again, just Google Taffy Taylor Swift, you'll find it. The headline is My Delirious Trip to the Heart of Swiftiedom. It's in the New York Times. It's got to be a solid 20,000 words about her attending a Taylor Swift concert.
Okay, I'd read that.
It was great. I loved it. Another friend that I recommended it to didn't like it so much, who does like Taylor Swift. She found it, she thought it was kind of over-intellectualizing the whole thing.
That's not what Taffy does.
A bit too clever, in my friend's words. But I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Mia Friedman wrote a fantastic piece about Taylor Swift and the experience of going to a concert, which was, you know, I thought as good as the Taffy piece, but it was much, much shorter. So if you just want a sampling of something interesting, you can do that. Then there's a brilliant piece that was in The New Yorker called Listening to Taylor Swift in Prison. And it is written by a guy who was doing 20 for murder.
Wow.
And he became unscratchably addicted to Taylor Swift and he was just desperate for all the new albums to drop and all the other prisoners knew that he loved Taylor Swift. And it's about his experience of why he connected to Taylor Swift's music. It's an amazing piece of writing.
Wow.
Yep, highly recommend that. And that there endeth my content about Taylor Swift. But I've got more pop culture content.
Sure, that's fine.
The Greatest Night in Pop, have you watched it?
No.
Oh, okay. It's on Netflix. It's about the making of We Are the World. I thought you might have watched it. Oh,
okay. No, but I feel like you have a very sparky need to tell me what it is.
I have been dying.
Which actually works very well with my need to not talk very much.
So, oh, okay. I was really hoping that you might have seen it actually, because I really want to bounce off someone to talk about it. So it is about the making of the song We Are the World, which I'm sure you know.
Yep. I'm with you.
Good. Okay, so I realised when it started, I've never given one second's thought to the making of We Are the World, of who wrote it. How did they coordinate everyone's diary to be in that location on the one night?
You've never thought about that before?
Have you?
Yeah, I have, because
wow.
I feel like I've seen another doco in which it's sort of vaguely canvassed. It's some like a doco about somebody else's life, and a little segment of it is, and then this person, whoever it was, went to do.
Oh, okay. Maybe was it about Michael Jackson? Maybe, because I'm just visualizing who was there and thinking who was deceased. Or not.
Yeah, I don't know, but like I definitely feel like I've watched a doco before. This is a good anecdote, isn't it? It's got all the detail. Just go and find it. It was brilliant.
Unstoppable.
So all I'm saying is that yes, I have before thought, geez, that was actually a bloody enormous day, wasn't it? I mean, how did they record that with all those people?
Well, okay. You're a better person than me, because that thought had never crossed my mind. So it kind of starts, and then so Lionel Richie is kind of the central talent in the doco, and Lionel Richie was kind of one of the absolute driving forces of it. In fact, he sings the first couple of lines in the song. It was written by Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson. They rang Stevie Wonder to ask would he help write it, and then he just didn't call them back. And he showed up at the last minute and they were like, mate, the song's written. We're recording it tomorrow. You'll be here tomorrow night for it. Anyway, they've basically rolled on. They've had cameras rolling across the whole recording session, basically. Okay. So they've got all the great behind the scenes chitter chatter and
that's cool.
And stuff. It blows your mind when they kind of go around the room and you just realise, oh man, it'd be like today if you had Taylor Swift and Beyonce and Harry Styles and everyone in the same room.
Lee Sales.
All the greats of the era. And just the amount of talent is so kind of gobsmacking.
Okay, so what I want to know is the politics of the talent. What's happening? Is there any kind of like, so how do you dish out the scenes? Like, I mean, how do you dish out the lines? How do you say,
well, that was
you're
challenging.
Going to get the, so, there's a choice we're making.
So Quincy Jones, who's the producer, who is I've banged on about him on the pod before, an absolute genius. I mean, Quincy Jones and Stevie Wonder would be two of my all-time favourites. I think they're both bona fide geniuses. Quincy Jones arranged it and he decided who was doing what in proximity to whom and so forth. And so there's a bit where Dionne Warwick says, she has a harmony with Willie Nelson. She's like, well, my eyebrows raised when he told me I was getting paired with Willie Nelson. But they actually sound fantastic together.
They do.
And so there's some great little snippets of colour where everyone walks in and they're all a bit mind blown, right, because it's just the greatest rock acts. And they've had to keep it all a secret as to exactly who's participating so it kind of doesn't all get derailed. So they all walk in and they're like, it's Michael Jackson, it's whatever. They've done contemporaneous interviews with Cyndi Lauper, Huey Lewis, Bruce Springsteen, Lionel Richie. So, yeah, it's fantastic. And so initially they're all kind of excited and chatty, and then Sir Bob Geldof's there and he says to them,
Sir Bob,
here's the reason we're here, and that kind of, everyone is quite serious. So they do the kind of chorus part first, and then they line them all up in a semicircle, as you might recall from the video clip, and they all have to sing their individual line. And so when they start to do this, Huey Lewis is kind of mostly commentating this.
Huey Lewis. I mean, does he stack up?
I've got a massive crush on Huey Lewis after
watching this. Because I just, like all those names, I'm just thinking, oh, the Immortals and Huey.
Oh, Huey Lewis is awesome. He's got an awesome voice. I love Huey Lewis. Bar of love. It's a curious thing. He's great. Anyway, so Huey's like, everyone gets in the semicircle. He's towards the end of it. And he goes,
I love how you are ride or die. It's the Huey Lewis. Jeez, you are the greatest dag I've ever encountered. Anyway, keep going.
So they're basically in this semicircle where they've all got to do their individual lines. And Huey Lewis goes, everyone then realises I'm going to have to sing in front of Bob Dylan, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, everybody, all the great acts.
Just like that time we did the Play School song, remember? And like as we were warming up, who was singing in front of us?
I can't recall.
It was someone like within a, it was, oh, it was Kate Miller-Heidke.
Oh.
That's who it was. She was doing the song before us and we were just like, we are
this cooked. Is bad. This is bad. Well, that was what Huey Lewis was thinking. And well, so he's yeah. like.
Sorry, was Huey, was, correct me if I'm wrong or if I mistaken him for another dweeb. He was hip to be square, right?
Yeah. How can you think that person's a dweeb? He's awesome. Anyway, so he's kind of towards mm-hmm. the end of the semicircle and he says, everyone is, you can just palpably sense the mood change. Everyone's like, I got to bring my A game here. This is, and so, and then they've got, of course, because they've got all the overlay of everyone waiting to have their turn. You can see that everyone is like, oh my God. Anyway, so Huey's quite funny because he's like, I'm at the end of the circle. They're taking time to get to me. The person immediately before me is Michael Jackson. And he's like, my legs were actually shaking. My knees were properly knocking. Oh,
now
knocking.
I like Huey a bit too.
He was great. And then they get to his bit and they kind of work it out. But then they have a break. And so just for a bit of context, Bob Dylan has been in a few cutaways and Bob Dylan looks properly terrified and like he wishes to be beamed out of the room. He looks and he's kind of not singing along in the chorus. They say that Quincy Jones openly says, if you feel like you're not going to hit where we want to hit, just don't sing. It's fine. We need, you know, people to be on in this octave at this moment. So blah, blah, blah. And so Bob is looking properly petrified. So everyone does their line except Bob Dylan. Then they have a break. And then Huey Lewis says, everyone's kind of a bit standoffish. And then Diana Ross, legend, walks up to Daryl Hall of Hall & Oates.
And the artistic team formerly known as Hall & Oates.
Exactly.
Have you been just eating up that detail?
Absolutely mm-hmm. addicted to that yep. for anyone who's not following along at home, Hall & Oates, they've split and one of them has a restraining order basically out against the other one.
He's off his oats.
Diana Ross goes
and
up
Oates
to...
And Oates no longer has a hall pass. Sorry, I'll stop interrupting you because I'm loving every second. You're like a kid telling me about the best holiday ever.
You're going to love this, Doco. Yeah. Daryl Hall Diana Ross goes up to Daryl Hall and she goes, Daryl, I am your biggest fan. I absolutely love you. Would you please sign my score? And then Huey goes, it just opens the floodgates. Everyone is getting everyone to sign their music after this. Anyway, so then Quincy Jones, he can see that Bob Dylan is having a very difficult time. And so he goes, clear the room. Everyone who's not in Bob's, you know, required, out. So they get everyone's line except Bob Dylan's. And then so all that's left in the room basically is Quincy Jones, Stevie Wonder at the piano because he's helping people pick out harmonies, and Bob Dylan. And they go, okay, Bob, give us your line. And so Bob is, I don't think I've ever seen someone quite so obviously paralyzed with sheer terror.
God.
And so Bob kind of just mumbles into the microphone, like you can't even really hear him, like, we are the world. And then they finish the one line and whatever Bob's line is, which is not what I just said. And then Quincy goes, he was so emotionally intelligent how he handled the whole thing. Quincy goes, oh, mate, you know, it's – he doesn't say mate, but the vibe is like, yeah. You know, it's good, Bob. It's good. Look, you're fine. And then Dylan goes, Steve, help me. And Stevie Wonder basically does an impersonation of Bob Dylan to Bob Dylan's face. I don't know. And Quincy Jones in the voiceover, it was, and Quincy Jones is dead now. It was clearly an old interview. He goes – Stevie is an incredible mimic of people. He's an amazing mimic.
Wow.
And so he basically does that. Now, the line that Bob Dylan sings, I wish I should have Googled what it actually is before I came in, but he's not singing the melody and he's also not singing a harmony, which is
I'm
kind of
how – I'm trying to rack my brains to remember his line in the song.
You have to have a listen to it and you'll hear exactly what I mean. It sounds absolutely perfect Bob Dylan because it's kind of – you know when Bob Dylan sings –
So are you saying this is Stevie Wonder's voice?
No, it's Bob Dylan's voice, but Stevie Wonder basically –
shows
mimicked
him how to do it.
Bob Dylan to Bob Dylan's face, and then Bob Dylan mimicked the impersonation of himself to do the line that Stevie Wonder did. It's phenomenal. But the thing that's the most touching, well, firstly, you're just blown away by, I don't quite know how Stevie Wonder found this part for Bob Dylan because, like, the only way I can describe it is it's like it's in the cracks of the music, which is, I think, how Bob Dylan often sings. It's kind of, he's not on a melody, he's not on a harmony, but it kind of works. Mm. So Stevie Wonder picks...
So no wonder why he felt out of place and...
Completely.
Yeah,
absolutely
wow.
out of place. So Stevie furnishes him with this line and then they record it and the transformation in Bob Dylan's manner is...
Because he's delighted at what he's just heard.
He's delighted and he just knows, I know how to do it now. I've got my bit. And then he just smashes it. It's absolutely fantastic. He delivers it beautifully. It sounds just like you want Bob Dylan to sound.
But I feel like crying, actually.
It's emotional watching it because of his... the transformation in his demeanour when the pressure is lifted and he kind of then feels comfortable. It's really quite something to watch. That for me, that was the highlight of the whole doco. Also, Bruce Springsteen, he's just a heavenly human being. He's absolutely lovely, both on the day when they're recording and in his present day interview. And then there's a great – Lionel Richie also is just adorable. And there's a great bit at the end where Lionel says Quincy was dropping him home and he goes to him, "Man, those white boys really brought it to D." Anyway, it is
Quincy
so...
Quincy was dropping him home.
I was crying and laughing and it was great.
God, talking about just... this just popped into my head when you started talking about Quincy Jones. I was remembering that the other night when Mardi Gras was on and we were just sort of watching the broadcast, the ABC broadcast, and at the end of... basically me marvelling at Jeremy Fernandez's fantastic outfit.
Oh, he looks great.
Right? Then afterwards after it was all wrapped up, there was Courtney Act programming rage. And one of the first songs was Grace Jones' Slave to the Rhythm. Far out, that is an incredible film clip. I love the film, you know, Slave to the Rhythm. It is an incredible piece of filmmaking. The film clip is unbelievable. Anyway,
oh, I must Google it. I can't have a look.
It's just, I mean, I remember thinking at the time, "Oh, this is really cool," but to look back and think of it, I mean, what year would that have been? Like, definitely the '80s. It is like a filmic masterpiece. It's an unbelievable piece of work. The film clip, yeah.
I just went to opening night of Anne Juliet, which is just and it's full mostly of songs written by the one person who's a songwriter called Max Martin. They're all popular culture songs that you'd recognise. My goodness, it blows your mind to see this guy's catalogue of pop songs that are like all massive hits and all highly recognisable. The song that mostly went off on the night was Backstreet Boys, "Everybody, yeah, rock your body." But then it was like Raw by Katy Perry and I Kissed a Girl.
So that's the idea behind the, like, because I've read a little bit about this show. So it's using those songs to thread through the story.
Yep. And so the basic gist of it is, what if Juliet actually didn't die? And the kind of how they've done it is William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway are kind of having an argument, and Anne Hathaway is going, "Well, why do you have to end it like this? You should end it with that she doesn't die, and what, you know, why is she going to throw a life after this waster?" And then basically it kind of picks up from Juliet hasn't died, and then here's what happens, and then they use these songs woven throughout to kind of just keep furthering the narrative. It's really good fun. The audience absolutely loved it. I feel like I'm on a just total monologue here and that I should let
That's
you...
good though, because my voice is a bit hurty, so actually really suiting me to listen and occasionally to mock you.
Well, it's really suiting me to just get an unbroken monologue.
No, I just enjoy it while you can, lady.
Now, I'm torn about which direction to go now because I've got...
Because you've got...
I've got so many options now.
You've got open road in front of you.
I've got open road in front of me. I could go down the musical road to something else I saw.
And we'll never, ever get home.
Or I could stick in the 70s, 80s pop culture. What would you like?
I'll keep going with music because, you know, that's something where, you know.
So I went in Melbourne to see Groundhog Day, the musical.
This is Tim Minchin's musical.
Tim Minchin's musical. I absolutely loved it. It was so great.
You're on fire with your musical attendees.
Yes. I've been in a very purple patch of being able to consume culture, which has been great. Groundhog Day, the musical... People will, of course, remember the famous film starring Bill Murray and the basic gist of it that he's a weather forecaster who's been sent to a town in Pennsylvania, and they have the groundhog that come every year. The groundhog dictates how much longer winter's going to go for, kind of thing. And he hates this assignment.
Puxatawny Bill.
Puxatawny Phil.
Phil.
Yeah. So Puxatawny's the town. And so Bill Murray hates being sent on this assignment. He's not a very nice person. And then something happens and he just keeps waking up and repeating the same day over and over and over again, and it's Groundhog Day. And so they've built a musical around it. Interestingly, it didn't do well in the United States when it opened, the musical. It had a very short-lived kind of run, even though people thought it was a great show. It just didn't land for whatever reason. And there's lots of, you'll be unsurprised to know, I've done the internet deep dive on this.
Of course you have.
And there was various theories about it, such as, you know, other musicals that opened around the same time and just...
Wasn't it around 9/11 or something? No. I feel like it was around some sort of big event.
It was...
That had a...
Earlier, that it was after, so it was quite a bit later than 9/11, but there was various theories around, I think it wasn't Wicked, but there was other major shows right. that opened around the same time that were very big.
So it ran for a long time in the UK, didn't it?
It did. Yeah. So it was a huge hit in the UK. Mm. The same guy has played the Bill Murray character in Broadway, West End, and now in Australia.
Okay.
His name is Andy Carl. He won an Olivier for it on West End. It's so good. You know when you see, you saw Matilda, right?
Of course, yeah.
You know how in Matilda there's moments that give you a feeling of genuine wonder, yep. right? And you mm-hmm. kind of, you leave the theatre and you go, well, that was money well spent, and that just made me, I feel so happy. I'm just walking on air, walking out of this theatre. Yep. It has moments like that. Like we were so happy when we left, and there's a wonderful number in it where there's some illusions that occur. And I was there with Lisa Miller. At one point, I just turned to her and went, "How are they doing this? How are they doing it?" And she was at the end like, "God, you're so hilarious! Like clearly, it's an illusion, Salesy. They've got an illusion, but you were just so into it, buying
it
all."
That is the Minchin magic, though, isn't it? Like as well, like just these sort of little spinnerets of words and melodies that are just, you know how sometimes you get a great melody and kind of like okay words, but
so
the rhythm of the
clever.
Language. Yeah,
oh, so clever. Yeah. So it was just an utterly delightful night out, and I kept thinking, God, how are they going to make this a musical, and how are they going to keep repeating the same day over and over again? How's it actually going to work? It just worked a treat. It was laugh aloud funny. It was touching. It was... I can't rave more highly about it.
There's a new film coming out in the next, I think in the next little while, not long now, which is a film that's made of the musical that was made of the movie Waitress.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So okay. The film Waitress.
Starring our old mate Kerry Russell from the Americans.
That's right, yeah. But also it was like this extraordinary story about the writer and director of that film who died, I think, not long after it was made, very tragically. And the story then was made into a musical.
Right.
I'm not sure of the exact TikTok here.
Also called Waitress.
Yep.
Right.
And that musical score, that musical soundtrack is on high rotation in my house. Everybody is in love with it. And we started listening to it during lockdown. And now there's a film made of the musical that's about to come out.
Oh, right.
And I just am in transports of excitement about it.
Speaking of stuff that we've previously been in love with and that's on high rotation in your house, do you know Hamilton's coming back to Sydney?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Do you know, sometimes I think back, just before anyone listening to this podcast goes,
oh,
please,
oh,
God,
here they go
not
again.
About to go
Jesus,
again
shut up.
Hamilton. It's sometimes, because now it's a while back, I just remember that period when we first became addicted to it, how
when it was locked down.
Day you and I would text each other and go, what earworm did you wake up with today? It was months and months.
Yep.
Where
that's because
we
weren't doing anything
it.
Else.
Yeah,
we possibly. Like lockdown. But, yeah, I mean, and my kids learned all the words to all of them, all of the songs, and, you know, mastering the cabinet battle raps. And
our
you
level
know.
Of obsession with it. And yeah. I remember your family all getting up en masse at 7 a.m. or whatever day it was when the Disney film version of it dropped, having not seen it before.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of, again, like in terms of magical experiences.
Oh, yeah.
That,
making memories.
Yeah, they just, those things, I think, when you love a show like that or you love the music and you go and see it and then it just, you know.
I'll happily watch it beginning to end any day.
But. Yeah. It's, will you go and see it again?
Yeah, absolutely.
Same,
of
course.
Absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt.
The other bit of 80s pop culture I was going to tell you about is I knocked over, it was a really easy read, it only took me a couple of hours. So Henry Winkler, the Fonz, has written a book called Being Henry, the Fonz and Beyond.
No way.
Yes. It's a lovely read.
Does he just say, sit on it, Mrs. C?
Actually, it should have been called Sit On It. That would have been
a good title
for it. It's lovely. He has a reputation for being one of the nicest people that you'd ever meet. I didn't realise he has done Because, I mean, he obviously had an issue with being typecast as the Fonz kind of, you know, early on in his career. But he has done a lot of stuff. He did a lot of stuff behind the scenes. And then he's also done a lot of stuff and been very successful on camera too in Arrested Development and then recently in Barry. It was just a very interesting
read. He can jump a shark.
He can jump a shark. He addresses that. He addresses the
created the
as he points
expression.
Out. I didn't realize Happy Days went on for another few seasons after the jumping the shark.
Oh yeah,
incident. So it's kind of for me because I grew up in the era when Happy Days was on telly.
Yeah,
I mostly enjoyed reading about Happy Days, and then of course I love Arrested Development and Tony Hale and all of those Jason Bateman and all of that crew, Will Arnett. So I enjoyed reading about that as well. But yeah, he just seems like a lovely dude. It's a very easy read if you're looking for a celebrity memoir to read. Look no further.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm up for that. I'm up for that in a large way.
Excellent.
Haven't done much book-wise this podcast so far, have we?
No, because it's all coming up in the next podcast.
Oh, is that what it is? I will mention that I finished watching Feud, the Truman Capote.
Yes.
Have you finished?
My binge has been Swans. Playing up. I've been trying to watch the final.
Well, I'm sure there's an ointment for that, love.
Can you take a look? Can you take a look at my binge when we leave here and see what's going on with it?
I'm not going anywhere near your binge I wouldn't go near your binge with somebody else's bloody stick, mate.
Oh, Jesus.
All right.
Once again, I apologise to the listeners at home.
No, no, truly.
You thought that my 15-minute monologue on Deadpool was problematic.
So, all right, speaking from my diaphragm now, Solange, yes. Feud.
My binge is playing up. I haven't been able to see the end of it. I think I'm only missing the final episode.
Right.
The last episode I saw was the one where the dude who wrote Roots comes over to give him a talking to.
Right. Yeah, James Baldwin.
Yes. Okay. No, hang on, I'm thinking of the wrong book.
What?
Did James Baldwin – no, Alex Haley wrote Roots.
James
It's James Baldwin who
comes over. Yes, it's James Baldwin who comes over. Yeah, I found that a really transfixing scene on a number of levels. A, because Chris Chalk, who's playing James Baldwin, has the most incredible screen presence. But B, I also thought it was a really interesting device because, A, look, I don't remember enough about and I haven't done a deep dive yet to work out whether James Baldwin and Truman Capote actually were that friendly.
Yeah.
I also wonder whether the producers of this series have had a look at, you know, essentially the story arc and gone, this is the widest story ever told.
Oh.
And so I wondered if that interaction, which was really interesting and was really significantly about how white the world of the Swans was.
Oh, right.
If was they did sort of, engineered to address that because otherwise they're probably, I'm not sure that there necessarily was, I don't know, it would have been a weird, I mean, as a viewer, I certainly am watching it and thinking, geez, I mean, like this is a very kind of creme de la creme of New York society at the time.
Yeah.
And it's the whitest thing you could possibly imagine. And like, and what sort of, passed for diversity at the dinner parties or whatever was inviting gay men.
Right.
Anyway, I thought, Chris Chalk is amazing.
He was
the
incredible.
Scene is quite remarkable.
I've just quickly skimmed James Baldwin's Wikipedia while you've been talking to see if
friends
there's
with
any...
Truman Capote?
Well, that's what I'm just, there's no,
famously
there is
friends,
a, there is a thing that's like a subheading inspiration and relationships and Truman Capote's not named in there. But I mean, obviously he would have, surely he would have known Truman Capote because
there's this kind of like we're two gay men who are great writers, you know.
Yeah.
Hello, let's
they
have
would
dinner.
Have they would have passed, but whether as you say whether they were friends.
And it's kind of I mean the way that the scene is sort of conjectured is that Baldwin takes him out for lunch and says, you know, and he's written the article, he's been dumped by Babe Paley and all her friends and he's, you know, spiralling into drink and so on. And Baldwin shows up and takes him out for lunch and at one point Capote, who's played, as we've discussed before, by Tom Hollander.
Brilliantly.
Not Tom Hollands. somehow, and he just says, well, I'll take you out for lunch because you need to have some family. and, you know, and us gay boys have got to stick together, basically. Yeah. And then they launch into this broader discussion.
Is that the second last episode?
No, I think it's the third to last. Oh, so I reckon you've got a couple left once you get your mingery twiddled. I mean, your binge refiddled.
James Baldwin's most famous book is, of course, Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Right, yes.
Yeah, that actor was...
Roots my boot.
Absolutely superb. Yeah. I mean, that whole series, I've been cross that my... Binge has been on the blank because it's...
Stop saying it.
I was crossed to not be able to finish watching it.
And it's quite... it gets a bit... Like there's a bit of... Having just watched that series of The Crown with the ghostly appearances and like sort of shit-canned that, like kind of like there's a bit of ghostliness back and forth. Ow. But like, I mean, that's already happened too because What's-Her-Name shows up as his mum and addresses him
at some
point.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I mean.
Isn't it funny though when it's kind of a bit better done? Like that didn't jar on me.
I can deal with the ghost as long as it's,
also because it's. Isn't that funny how until you said that and I was like, oh, that's right, Jessica Lange wafts in and
out. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, look, I mean, everybody dies in the end, of course. We know how the whole story ends. But I found the last episode really affecting, actually.
Ah.
It was, more than I was expecting it to. Anyway, in general, loved it. I really enjoyed the series.
Yeah,
and
Tom Holland
was just ridiculously, ridiculously talented. And if you want to spin off on a little Tom Hollander, and I think we've already canvassed this possibly, Murph might have in the newsletter, but like the mix up between Tom Holland, who's the, you know, Marvel, you know, multi-bisquillionaire recompensed actor, and Tom Hollander, the star of this show, and who also was, you know, in the second series of the Jennifer Coolidge, these top end gays are trying to kill me, you know.
White Lotus.
There's a great anecdote that is just, you can Google easily, about Tom Hollander accidentally being paid Tom Holland's pay packet or his bonus of his extra bit of his pay packet or something. It was like gajillions more than Tom Hollander's ever been paid for a movie. And he's just
classic.
Like, what's happened? And it turned out that they'd mixed it up.
Oh.
And he'd got, Tom Holland's. Yeah.
Dave Hollander.
And then if you want to see why Tom Holland's is paid so much and you want a minute and a half or so of just untrammeled, pure joy.
Yeah.
Google Tom Holland's Singing in the Rain. And you'll get a dance sequence, a drag dance sequence featuring Tom Holland that is outrageous. I'll put the link to the clip.
Yeah, can you please? I'm just Googling it right now, so it's in my phone.
Okay,
so the second that we get out of here, we can do it. Oh, is it a lip sync battle?
That's right, it's a lip sync battle.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
I just cannot – I'm going to make you watch it and then enjoy your face as you watch it. It is just – Julia Baird showed it to me and my friend Joe Fox.
Oh.
Just – each of them watch it at least once a day.
Singing in the Room is my favourite film. So, I will look forward to this. Well, let's hurry up and wrap this up so that I can get on with it.
Uh-huh.
There's a couple of things we want to mention. Coming up is our tour with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. We are doing Brisbane.
Otherwise known as the greatest shameful act of pretense that we've ever committed which Annabelle Crabb has been physically pushed by Lee Sales.
So we are hanging out with the ACO on stage. They'll play some music. We'll ask some questions and do some witty banter with them, we hope. Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, just have a look on our website or just Google Crab Sales.
I'll tell you what, we've had a bit of a get together and a kind of like, is everybody actually okay with this? Because we're coming on stage and like just roping in, interrupting musicians and asking them all the things that I've always wanted to ask. Like, I mean, what happens when you're panicking up there and like, what if somebody does something wrong? Like, how do you fix it? What's the vibe like later?
Yeah.
What if somebody in the audience does something ridiculous? Do you
They've already told us some hilarious anecdotes that we are looking forward to getting into.
I think, I don't know, there's something that's so perfectly formed seeming about an orchestra that you feel like you're in the presence of immaculately organised humanity. And actually what's happening behind the scenes is so interesting.
Exactly.
I cannot wait for this.
It's going to be very, very fun. And then also the National Film and Sound Archive. Let me just say the name again.
Your binge really is on the blink, isn't it?
Let me speak from my diaphragm. The National Film and Sound Archive. They have got a new 6-part podcast called Who Listens to the Radio, which is about the history of radio in Australia. They do an amazing job, as does the National Archive. Like, I think we are very fortunate in Australia with our record keepers who are in this space. And the National Film and Sound Archive are awesome, and so this podcast, they've got such a wealth of material to draw on, and it is well worth your time.
NFSA, here to stay. Thank you for enjoying both the oral and the visual experience of me talking to this lady here. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for so much more content. It'll probably quell your enthusiasm, but give us a go or listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you ever think that we'd be telling people to subscribe to our content?
No, I did not.
We're cool at last.
Don't, you're making me look bad in front of my children again.